Rick Ganley. This is New Hampshire Public Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The Labor Department's new May unemployment numbers just came out, showing little change, now 8.2%. That's a slight uptick from April's unemployment rate, and it's not good news for the country. Yet the jobless data is part of a complicated and unsettled picture of our economy. 3 years since the recession officially ended, and the recovery has been slow at best. And over the next 6 months, political developments, both here and overseas, could make it worse. First, there's talk in Washington about the government falling off what they're calling a fiscal cliff if politicians don't act soon to reverse two policies. One is the Bush tax cuts, scheduled to expire at the end of the year. The other is automatic budget cuts required after the failure of the deficit super committee. The Congressional Budget Office says if both these actions take place, personal and government spending will drop, and that all could mean recession in 2013. Meanwhile, Europe's plight is getting worse, the euro's value is dropping, unemployment is rising, and member countries are squabbling over austerity versus government stimulus. And that could be even more bad news for us here in the U.S. Today in The Exchange, what's restraining our recovery and how these national and international trends might affect us in New Hampshire? Let's hear from you. What do you see holding our economy back from a more impressive recovery? What's your own personal economic picture look like? And do you see our country's overall economic outlook as brighter than indicated by some of these recent reports, or as even worse than some of the new numbers would indicate? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post your comments on our Facebook page. We have two guests. With me in studio is Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies and New Hampshire Forecast Manager for the New England Economic Partnership. And Dennis, always nice to see you. Thank you for being
here. Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, Matt Slaughter, Associate Dean of the MBA program and professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. He's a member of the Congressional Budget Office's panel of economic advisors. He also served as an advisor in the George W. Bush administration. And Matt, good to have you back, too. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, gentlemen, a big morning, and I'll turn to you first, Matt Slaughter. Your thoughts on those new unemployment numbers showing a slight uptick in the rate, 8.2, as I said, in May versus 8.1 in April?
Well, you're definitely right, Laura. The jobs report out this morning isn't great. The unemployment rate has risen. The broader unemployment rate that measures people who are working involuntarily part-time, for example, also rose a fair bit. The rate of jobs growth came in well below expectations, and the rate of jobs growth for the previous couple months was revised down. One additional number I'll give to frame the jobs crisis that America continues to deal with. As of May, we had about 111 million private sector jobs in the United States. That's the same number that we had 12 years ago in June of 2000. Yeah, so we've got a bit of recovery that's been happening, which has been great. But in the past few months, in part because of the issues you mentioned earlier of the challenges in Europe, the political uncertainties about policy here in America, all those things seem to really be slowing the rate of job growth in America in a way that's pretty worrisome.
And Dennis, could you pick up on something that Matt said, talking about how much jobs were expected to grow? There's an expectations game there, too.
Right. We've just been through kind of an economic Super Bowl in terms of data that got released over the last 24 to 36 hours. Yesterday, gross domestic product got had the second sort of look at it and came in at 1.9%, which was pretty much what people expected. And unemployment insurance claims were up. We had a lot of data releases over the evening on production in the European and Asian countries. And then, of course, the jobs report here, too. I mean, what most people were expecting the jobs report to be a bright light, about 150,000. Instead, it came in at 67,000. So that's about half of what people expected. And as Matt was pointing out, some of the underlying numbers are even more disturbing. An increase in the unemployment rate that was expected, at most analysts expect that to be at 8%, came in at 8.2. So, I mean, as somebody said just on Twitter a few minutes ago, this could be a disaster wrapped in a calamity, hidden in a fiasco.
Oh, dear. Tell me it's not that bad, Dennis.
Well, I hope it's not that bad. But I think there's a lot of uncertainty. Even as we speak right now, the oil prices just dropped to about $82 a barrel in the last time I looked at it, and the euro's dropped relative to the dollar. So we're living in a time of great uncertainty, unfortunately.
Well, and Matt, to you first, but Dennis, I want to hear from you too. You know, it's interesting to me that officially the recession ended 3 years ago this month, June of 2009. It was pronounced officially over. And yet, Matt, you know, we're still kind of just bumping along. How come?
Boy, that's the $64,000 question, Laura. It is. So a couple things are at play, I think. One is the rate of job recovery just remains really slow. That's in large part because a lot of companies still are really unclear about when their order books are going to start growing. I'm sure a lot of the listeners in New Hampshire are seeing this, and therefore when they're going to go out and make a little more investment in capital, hire another colleague or two. And you add that up across the economy and you get very sluggish job growth. And the reality is the U.S. economy for a lot of years has really depended on people in America with jobs going out and spending a lot, what economists call consumption spending. And part of the challenge for America is it would be great if in the coming years we could try to create more jobs in America linked to the global economy by investing and exporting to the rest of the world. But the challenges that are present in Europe that Dennis mentioned, which are in some ways getting worse by the hour, and slowdowns even in China and India, is making it hard for our country to create a lot of new jobs linked to the global economy.
Wow. Dennis, add in there, please.
Well, I think the real story to me is it looks like the end of the job creation machine that was the U.S. economy. I went back and for the conference that we did yesterday, looked at the rate of job creation over a 10-year period for the U.S. economy. And, you know, I'm sure Matt's looked at similar numbers. But if you go back to the 1960s, the 70s, the 80s, and look at the job picture in the U.S. at any point in time, we always had about 20% more jobs than we had 10 years earlier. You know, again, it would fluctuate a little bit based on recessions and recoveries, but generally we stuck at that 20% number. In the last 15 or so years, that's dropped. And again, as a result of the Great Recession, now we have, as Matt said, about the same number of jobs that we had 12 years ago. So there's almost no growth in the U.S. economy. And the New Hampshire and New England economies are showing the same type of pattern. So the real problem is this lack of job growth. I think in part it's tied to the lack of economic growth. I mean, if you look back in those periods, 60, 70, 80, when the U.S. economy came out of a recession, it came out very quickly. You know, we were back to, you know, 7, 8, 9% growth in a very short period of time. What we're looking at right now is 2 to 3% growth if we're lucky, and that's just not enough growth in the economy to create a lot of jobs.
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at the national economy, some of the worrisome trends that have been reported just this week, including today's jobless figures. We're looking at what those trends mean, especially for us here in New Hampshire and our own economy in the Granite State. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. Why do you think the recovery is not more impressive than it has been? It's been awfully slow, as we're hearing, in terms of job growth. What about your own personal economic situation? And if you're a business owner, what are your thoughts on why other businesses are not hiring as strongly as everyone would like them to? Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org, or you can post your comments on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, again, people want businesses to hire, especially now, Matt, right? Because the federal government and the state and local governments are cutting back.
Yeah, absolutely. That's been a real dynamic that's continued to be at play, which is state and local and the federal governments, they're trying to right-size their budgets. That means that to get a lot of job creation going, you need both large and small businesses, hopefully, to feel more confident, see increases in their order book, and go out and buy a lot more at capital goods and hire more people. And you alluded to an important issue the U.S. is going to be facing more and more in the coming months earlier, Laura, which is this fiscal cliff that people talk about at the federal level. There's a lot of laws on the books right now that if we reach New Year's on 2013 and policies haven't changed, there's going to be major increases in taxes for a lot of families and workers and businesses, and there's also going to be major spending cuts. All else equal, that fiscal austerity that will kick in quite dramatically at the beginning of 2013 will tend to reduce a lot of business activity, a lot of incomes for people. And the best guess of the Congressional Budget Office today is that would tip the U.S. back into a recession, independent of what happens in the Europe crisis and elsewhere in the world.
So fiscal policies here at home, Matt.
Yeah. And the big problem, and Dennis alluded to this earlier with one of his insights, is the longer we go along without having some clear resolution from Washington about what's going to happen at the end of this calendar year fiscally, the more families and workers and businesses reasonably think, I don't know what my tax rate's going to be come January 1. I'm going to hold back on spending and hiring a little bit. And it becomes a dynamic that reinforces the slow economic growth.
So this fiscal cliff, Dennis, just to be crystal clear, one is the Bush tax cuts are scheduled to expire. Yes. If they are allowed to expire, a lot of people's taxes will go up. So that's one part of this fiscal cliff. The other is under that failed deficit super committee, when they flunked that test, that meant automatic spending cuts go into effect. And if that doesn't change, that means government spending stops. So personal spending, government spending, all going down, that means a contraction.
Well, again, what we're really talking about here is the government role in economic activity and what the CBO is saying, and I think they're correct. I mean, a lot of other private economists are confirming these numbers, that if the Bush tax cuts do go into effect, and if the automatic cuts that were part of the Deficit Reduction Committee failure go into effect next year, that's going to take about 4%, 3 to 4% out of economic growth. Now, we've only been growing
at about
that 2 to 3%. So that means that next year we'd have a decline in overall economic activity solely because of what's going to happen at the government level. At the conference we were at yesterday, economy.com talked about that, and their expectation is about half of that's going to get legislated away. In other words, some deal will come, you know, probably just before Christmas that'll extend the Bush tax cuts and kick it into next year and probably cut back on the stabilizers as well.
So it'll be a cliff, but not quite so big a cliff.
Right.
We'll talk more after a short break and start taking your calls, so stay with us.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. More on a new case of economic jitters on the exchange on NHPR. And at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather for today, some sunshine, but clouds on the increase. High temperature is 70 to 75 degrees. Tonight, clouding up, lows from 45 degrees from Coos County, around 50 degrees for the Lakes region and Connecticut River Valley area, 55 degrees in southern parts of the state. For tomorrow, cloudy with rain at times, much cooler, highs only 57 to 62 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the law firm of Raff Young and Pignatelli, serving the business and nonprofit community, national impact, uniquely New Hampshire, on the web at rafflaw.com. And from the Altus Investment Group in Concord, one office managing $40 million of retirement nest eggs for baby boomers in central New Hampshire, altusinvest.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a look at some of the economic jitters that have been in the news this week, including new unemployment figures out just this morning showing that the nation's jobless rate ticked up from 8.1% in April to 8.2% in May. Join us with your comments and thoughts on why this economic recovery has been so slow. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. With me in studio, Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, New Hampshire forecast manager for the New England Economic Partnership, and Matt Slaughter joins us from Hanover, associate dean of the MBA program at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. And both of you, let's go to the phones. And George is calling in first from Canaan. Hi, George. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Hi. In response to the question, why is it taking so long for recovery to kick in? First of all, this was called a recession and treated as such. Then it was upticked to a great recession. I personally believe that it's a form of depression. because of its worldwide and therefore more complex nature. I think that the so-called job creators are not in it to create jobs. They're in it to make profits. They're sitting on lots of money and are not really interested in creating jobs.
You know, go ahead.
Those, particularly Republicans, who want to take a one-approach method, which is to reduce taxes, as they have been for years, and to wish that that would create jobs, and to stop spending, are going at it the wrong way. It has to be a more nuanced and balanced approach.
So two points here, George. Yeah, and, you know, one of the points that he makes is about government policy, and we talked about that a little bit before. But picking up on his first point, first, Matt Slaughter, a depression, do you think that's overstating it or what?
Well, it's clearly a very severe recession. It's a little bit of semantics about whether it's a depression or not. But George's insight is it was a worldwide phenomenon. It was very complex. And one of the important points that we all need to keep in mind is the nature of this recession was different from a lot of earlier recessions in America in previous decades because it was largely caused by and aggravated by the financial crisis. A lot of earlier recessions in the past many decades in America were more triggered by what economists sometimes call overheating. The economy demand was growing a little too quickly. Prices were starting to rise faster than policymakers like. And so the Fed, our central bank in particular, tends to tighten monetary policy at those times. That reduces demand and employment, and output drops a bit, and then the Fed relents. But when you have a financial crisis, the damage to the balance sheets of families, of businesses, it takes a lot more time typically for that real damage to be undone. And I think one of the points I'll make on this is George alluded to a lot of businesses that aren't hiring. One of the reasons that they're not hiring that's clear in the data is actually they still remain pretty skittish about how severe the crisis was in terms of impairing their ability to meet payroll, to pay vendors, to go out and try to find customers. So businesses have been saving a lot more in the past couple of years. And when you look at surveys of both large and small businesses alike, they still remember how scared, in some basic sense, they were in 2008 and 2009. And it takes time to work through that kind of fear.
You know, Dennis, I have heard others say, though, what George said, that businesses are more interested in healthy profits than hiring. And that term, sitting on piles of cash, has been used before. I've heard others say it.
Well, actually, George is right about that. U.S. businesses have never been more profitable. Corporate profits, the after-tax corporate profit margin right now is approaching 18%, and we've never seen that since ever. You can go back to the 1940s, and it's never been that high. But I think the point that Matt's making is a really, really important one. Businesses are scared. For lack of a better term, and all of the kind of things that actually we've been talking about in the first half hour and the kind of news that's been coming out today reinforces that sense of unease about, well, are we really going into – I think people really feel that we might be going into a double-dip recession. You can't blame them for being cautious, especially given what they've been through in the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, I also want to pick up on his other point, and both of you. Matt, you first. He mentioned, as we talked about earlier, government policies. He said, look, reducing taxes, reducing spending is not the way to go. I guess I have a broader question. You know, how much do these government policies have an immediate impact on the economy, and especially now that it's sort of bumping along?
So they definitely have an immediate impact in two important ways. One is the overall level of government spending and taxing has an impact on the incomes that businesses and people see through things like unemployment insurance, through things like the tax rates that businesses and people pay. So as governments, we talked about the fiscal cliff, and the reality is current policy is going to be a tightening of fiscal policy in America that's going to reduce the business and income for a lot of workers and families. But the other thing that's at least as important, I think, is people talk about the policy environment. And I think that speaks to what's the corporate tax code, what's the health insurance laws in the country, what's the nature of our immigration laws, our trade and investment policies with the rest of the world. And I think there's a lot of compelling evidence that in America and actually in a lot of other countries, definitely Europe, the nature of uncertainty about these kind of business policies that affect the day-to-day choices of business owners is a lot higher today than it was 5 years ago. And that's just a reality that governments, I think, need to address and try to work through.
You know what I'm confused about, though, is that, you know, on the one hand, we're told deficits and high debt are bad for the economy. And yet, Dennis, we're told that if we take these steps to reduce the deficit, raise taxes, reduce spending, that's the fiscal cliff we talked about,
right,
that's bad for the economy. So, you know, what are we supposed to do? It's the classic rock between a rock and a hard place.
Well, actually, Robert Reich and had a really good idea. And I'm always on the outlook for good ideas about the economy. He's been saying in the last couple of days or so that, you know, really, if you think about this fiscal cliff problem, we've been here before. It's a timing issue. The Bush tax cuts are set to expire at the end of the year.
Meaning higher taxes for a lot of
people. The automatic stabilizers or cuts to the economy, government spending are set to start in 2013. Robert Reich has been saying, well, why are we doing this based on some kind of time limit? Why don't we do it based on other things like the growth rate in the economy or the level of unemployment? You know, wait till the unemployment rate gets to 5%, then, you know, put the cut back on the Bush tax cuts or repeal them. Why not wait till economic growth gets to 3 to 4, maybe even 5%? Because really, if you think about it, the right time to do government austerity is when the economy is growing, not when the economy is in a slow growth mode. So change the way that you time these things, and maybe that'll have an impact.
So don't time them according to some arbitrary calendar, but
right,
time them according to what is really happening
right
out
and
there
the
in
whole
the
point of the arbitrary calendar is because legislators have difficulty sort of meeting deadlines. We've seen that time and time again. We saw that last summer with all of the discussion about extending the debt ceiling. We saw it, and that was all what the super committee about reducing the debt was all about. Congress tries to impose these arbitrary deadlines because they know they can't really agree on something. There's probably a better way to do it, and I think Robert Reich's idea is a good one.
Well, and before we go back to our listeners, to you too, Matt, you know, it's starting to feel like we're holding a talk show in Europe. We're talking about austerity versus stimulus. What do you think?
Let's hope we're not Europe. No disrespect to the good people there. Dennis's point about timing is a very important one in two ways. One is, yes, right now if the federal government contracts fiscal policy, that will tend to reduce output and jobs in America. But the challenge for the United States, like the challenge playing out in many countries in Europe today, is at some point America can't continue to run the magnitude of deficits we've been running in recent years. In fiscal 2009, 10, and 11, the total federal budget deficits came to about $4 trillion. And the one friendly amendment I'll make to Dennis's points is what many countries in Europe are showing is the issue of timing is not always in the control of government policymakers. When governments are running these larger deficits, they become to some extent beholden to savers and creditors around the world and whether or not they're willing to, in some literal sense, show up at the debt auctions that these governments hold and purchase their debts. So you see countries now like Greece and Spain most vividly struggling with economies that, on George's question, truly are in depressions on some measures, but with an inability to finance a lot of the fiscal stimulus they might like to.
I see.
Hope is we don't get to that point in America. But, you know, a few years ago, a few people were predicting this was going to be the outcome for Greece and Spain and those types of countries.
So at some point you lose the flexibility, Matt, to conduct your own fiscal policy because your creditors are banging at the door.
That's right. And the paradox right now for America is because fiscal situations are so dire in so many other countries, the United States right now is perceived as having relatively safe government debt. The interest rates our U.S. government pays in recent weeks is literally at historic lows. The same is true for the government of Germany. But that is partly a reflection of the fear that's present among a lot of investors around the world about how bad things are in other countries.
Our phone number again here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. George, thanks a lot for those points. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. What's your own economic outlook these days? Does it look better or worse than what the new national numbers seem to say? Also, why do you think our recovery has been so slow and so uncertain? What's holding that economic recovery back? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, here's an email that came in from Fred in Lee. He says, I'd be interested in hearing whether DeLay and Slaughter think the problem with the economy, especially unemployment, is cyclical or structural. He says, if it's purely cyclical, monetary policy would be taking us out of the doldrums. If it's structural, fiscal and monetary policy is not likely to be as much of a help, as the problems may be caused by technological changes, resulting in changes for employment opportunities, demographics, an aging population, major changes in U.S. competitiveness relative to the rest of the world. Can you answer that, Matt, in real layperson terms, if you could? Cyclical or structural?
Yeah, that's a great question that Fred asks. Short answer is it's some of both. The trickier question is how do you break it out 50-50 or what the shares are. Some of it is cyclical, but it's not all cyclical because we know that the Fed has been running very, very loose monetary policy in recent years, and we've already talked about how large the U.S. fiscal deficits have been. The evidence that at least some of it is structural, there's a lot of numbers you can point to. One that I like is manufacturers. The company Deloitte did a really neat survey and wrote a report that came out about a month or two ago where they surveyed thousands of businesses in America in manufacturing and said, why is it difficult for you to hire people right now, or what's going on with the job situation for you? And adding up the survey results, they found that at least 500,000 job openings for American manufacturers right now are not going filled by those companies because they can't find workers with the skills that they need, the numeracy, the literacy, the computer programming skills. So part of the structural challenge that America faces right now is some deep things that have been brewing for a long time. And one, I think, is just the fact that our educational system, both in terms of middle and high schools and at the college level, we're not upgrading the skills of Americans nearly as well or nearly as much in recent decades like we did over much of the 20th century.
So structural problems are a lot harder to solve then. You really have to take a deep, long look, Matt, at what you're doing economically.
Yeah, so if you look at the educational challenges in America, you look at our crumbling infrastructure, those are problems a lot of business people point to. You can't wave a magic wand and address those in a quarter or even a year. That clock on a lot of those things ticks decade by decade.
And Dennis, the skills gap, we've done a bunch of shows on that here in the Exchange.
Right. And by coincidence, the NEEP conference that we had in Boston yesterday, New England Economic Partnership Conference, was all about the skills gap, and the subtitle of that was Where Are the Jobs? And so we spent a lot of time yesterday in Boston at the Fed Bank talking about that issue. Again, I think Matt's right. It's partly cyclical, partly structural. I think it's more cyclical than structural. I mean, I think that the other big issue here is just a lack of demand, a lack of consumer demand. Pretty much a lot of consumer demand that we've had over the last decade or so has been fueled by the housing boom. And because that housing boom has now become a housing bust, that means a lot of things. It means that consumers have less money to put into their pocket. They can't borrow against their house to start a new business. So that hurts entrepreneurship. So, you know, it may sound like repeating ourselves to keep talking about the housing crisis and the financial crisis that we had a few years ago that, again, reached its apex in 2008. But it still is affecting us. I mean, it still is a big story in terms of what's going on in terms of economic growth. I mean, I think to some of the other points, we spent some time yesterday talking with Robert Schwartz, who's been looking at job training programs in the U.S. versus Europe. And, you know, what he found in a lot of his research was that, you know, yes, we did a very good job in the U.S. of sort of, you know, getting up our skill sets, but we sort of stagnated. And a lot of other countries are catching up to us. And probably more importantly than that, a lot of other countries, particularly European countries, have programs in place for non-college-educated people.
Yeah, the old-fashioned apprenticeship programs.
Internship programs, apprenticeship programs. Businesses are committed to that. Governments are committed to that. And it's a great thing to have 30% or so of our population, and even a higher percentage than that in New Hampshire, with a bachelor's degree or better. But what about the other 60 or so percent of the population that doesn't have that? What kind of skills do they have, and how do they fit into the needs, I think, that businesses are going to have going out in the future?
Let's take another call if we could. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Fred, thanks for that one. And to the phone, Steve is in Bedford. Hi, Steve. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Good morning, Laura. I love your show. I listen to it a lot. I'd like to inject a little bit of politics into this because I haven't heard much of that so far on the show. Some of the people who are perhaps in a position in government to have the most effect, that is, the Congress, the economy is not their number one priority because this is an election year. Their number one priority is to be reelected. So it seems to me, guess who's cheering whenever there's a bad number like this morning's job report? The Republicans are cheering because, oh boy, look at that. You know, they know that if the economy continues to tank, they're going to get reelected. That's the number one priority. If they're not thinking about job creation, it isn't going to happen.
Wow, that's a pretty pessimistic view, Steve. You think Republicans are excited the economy is going down?
Absolutely.
Even if their friends are losing jobs?
Their friends aren't losing jobs. Remember, their friends are typically the rich people.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I mean, I think there's rich people in both parties.
There's Republicans in every economic class. You're right. But in general, if you're not thinking about creatively about how to solve the country's problems, but instead you're thinking about how to get reelected, which one's going to happen?
Well, and for sure, political gridlock is an issue. What do you think about this, Matt?
So as a longstanding registered independent, I would say we can find a lot of fault with people on both sides of the aisle in Washington, D.C. on not addressing the real fiscal challenges facing America. I'll give two examples. One is a wonderful bipartisan committee chaired by Alan Simpson and Mr. Bowles was produced last year at the request of the president and pretty much everyone acknowledges ignored by all Republicans and Democrats in Washington in terms of not getting America to a point of having a plan for getting closer to fiscal balance over the medium and long term. And so right now I'll come back to the point that no one knows what will happen to a lot of tax rates and spending rules come January 1 of 2013. And the reality is it looks like it won't be until after the election in November that we'll get any policy movement on that.
All right. Well, and after a short break, Dennis, I want to ask you a little bit more about the New England and New Hampshire economic forecast that came out just yesterday. Get your take on those two, Matt, as well. We'll keep taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477. Email us at exchange@nhpr.org, and we'll be right back.
By now, you know you can donate your old car to NHPR. And you know how easy we make it by filling out the paperwork for you, picking up the car, and auctioning it off. But what you may not realize is that we accept more than just cars. You can donate anything to our vehicle donation program, from a snowmobile to an RV to a boat. Find out more at nhpr.org or give us a call and get the process started at 1-877-393-NHPR.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Maine, Sonoda, and Rodden, patent attorneys for companies that believe intellectual property is a business of the future. Maine, Sonoda, and Rodden on the web at mcr-ip.com. And Gibson's Bookstore in Concord welcoming Cy Montgomery June 16th at 11 with her book, Temple Grandin, How the Girl Who Loved Cows Embraced Autism and Changed the World. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at economic jitters nationally, internationally, and how they might affect us here in New Hampshire. Let's get your thoughts. Call in 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you'll go to our page, join the conversation there. And Dennis, I did want to ask you about the big economic meeting down at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston that you were at yesterday. As I said, you are the New England forecast manager, excuse me, the New Hampshire forecast manager for the New England Economic Partnership. What was your forecast yesterday for the New Hampshire economy? Give us some of the highlights.
Okay, well, the basic highlights are that New Hampshire's recovering a little bit faster than the rest of the country and a little bit better than the rest of the region, although not outstandingly so. Our unemployment rate here is about 5%. I expect that we'll see the same number of jobs that we had prior to the recession beginning, probably not until the spring of 2014. Now, that's about a 6 to 6.5 year recovery. That's a very long recovery.
Right.
Yeah. So, again, New Hampshire is suffering from the same things that we've been talking about, very slow growth, a lot of difficulty in creating jobs. The other thing that's been happening in New Hampshire, which we have seen this before in the early 1990s, but New Hampshire's been suffering out migration rather than in migration. You know, we've long had this position among the New England states, even among the states around the country, where we've been a very fast-growing state, both in terms of jobs and in terms of population. And those things have seemed to stop, at least in this recession. So, you know, we're looking a lot more like the rest of New England now than we used to.
We used to be the standout, and now we're looking like
everybody else. We used to be the standout. It's hard to see places where New Hampshire really stands out.
Wow. Well, and here's an email from Brian that gets exactly to that point, Dennis, who says, an important aspect of the current economy is that New Hampshire appears over the past several years to have developed a much more pedestrian growth rate, closer to or below the U.S. average for employment. He says job growth in New Hampshire has been lower than many of its New England neighbors. As of April, only Rhode Island had a lower rate of year-to-year job growth. Brian says this should be igniting debate over the direction of our state. Instead, we are patting ourselves on the back for a false interpretation of our economic performance. I am all for making the state attractive to business, but today, brains are the most valuable resource. Jobs will locate where skilled, well-educated individuals live. Brian concludes by saying, I fear we are focusing on the wrong asset in our efforts to make New Hampshire attractive to job growth. Lots of points there, Dennis.
Lots
we could probably do
points.
A whole show on that, but
lots
go ahead.
Lots of great points. I tend to agree. Brian and I have shared podiums from time to time doing conferences around the state, and I tend to agree with a lot of what Brian has said. I mean, that really we're looking at, yes, I mean, we can still point to a 5% unemployment rate as being one of the best in the country. But the real important thing, I think, for New Hampshire and actually for the rest of the country is job growth. And we're just not seeing that right now to the extent that we should see it. And I also agree with his point on the sort of the rise in the price of cognitive skills and the decrease in the price of motor skills. I mean, more and more what the economy is all about is rewarding people for the knowledge that they have and the skills that they show rather than, again, as things become more mechanized and we get more done with robots and so on, the price of motor skills has dropped. There's some interesting fallout from that. There's a study done recently that we could probably do another show on this. Study recently that suggests that the rise in wage inequality and the closing of the wage gender gap are probably due to those two things, the increase in the price of cognitive skills and the decrease in the price of mechanical skills.
Wow. Well, Matt, do you want to jump onto that, too, in terms of a national picture?
Sure, I would. And Brian raises a lot of insights that building on Dennis's. One of the things I'll pick up on is this rise in income inequality that a lot of people talk about that feeds into the Occupy Wall Street movement and things of the past year. What I find most worrisome about it is not just the rise in inequality per se, but the fact that such a large share of American workers, their real incomes, meaning adjusted for inflation, their real earnings have been falling for so many years. This has been affecting the median worker in America, the person who's got a high school degree, a little bit of post-high school education, but not a secondary degree. But in the past 10 to 15 years, even people with a four-year college degree, or even those with a non-professional master's degree, their average earnings in the United States have been falling, not rising. And I think that Dennis is right. The evidence is part of what's going on is the nature of technological change is affecting more and more workers. And I think this is an issue where globalization is playing a role as well. A lot of companies, even some moderately sized ones in New Hampshire and elsewhere, now have so many more opportunities for thinking about whom they hire around the world, thanks to IT innovations and things in countries like China and India and many other BRIC and beyond countries. And that dynamic is something that is quite new and, frankly, quite independent of the financial crisis. And even if we can hopefully get through some of the challenges of the financial crisis we've been talking about, that deeper jobs challenge that we're seeing even in New Hampshire isn't going to go away.
What did you call those countries, Matt? BRIC and beyond?
BRIC and beyond. So people have talked about the BRICS, which are Brazil, Russia, India, and China. But the beyond speaks to there are many countries, for example, in Africa that after struggling over much of the 20th century, in the past 10 to 15 years have started to put in place better economic policies, have been enjoying faster economic growth, and they're trying to attract and grow global companies to do some things there. So those BRIC and beyond countries, if they can grow fast, that presents an opportunity for America to build a lot of these jobs we need to here at home that could ideally be linked to the global economy. But that's not magically going to happen without the right kinds of government policies we've talked about on this show a bit, like trade and immigration and investment liberalization.
Well, and I was reading something real interesting yesterday, Matt, about how India's economic engine has been slowing down, partly due to political stalemate. And that's
right.
A problem for us.
It is. So a great example is in November of last year, the Prime Minister of India announced that they were going to liberalize their retail trade industry, which to date has had very strong protections against foreign companies doing business there. If they could open up their retail trade sector, companies like Target and Best Buy and Walmart that are great retailers based in America could expand in India, and that would create some jobs in communities like Minnesota, the Twin Cities in Minnesota, Bentonville, Arkansas, where a lot of these great U.S. retailers are based. But if India doesn't make those kind of reforms, or the U.S. doesn't try to work with India to open up those markets, it's going to make it harder for us to grow those kinds of jobs here at home that we need to.
Well, 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. And Brian, thanks for that email. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, we're on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page and join the conversation there. And let's go back to our callers, gentlemen. And another Brian joins us, this one from Concord. Hi, Brian. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ms. Canoys, gentlemen. Interesting talk. I was listening to BBC overnight, and Paul Krugman of the New York Times was being interviewed. Basically, I agree with Paul Krugman. We are in a Great Depression. We've been in a Great Depression since June of 07. It grew out of Bush's recession of summer of 01. According to the Washington Post a number of years ago, they had an in-depth article with graphs and charts delineating how we were already at 17.5% unemployment by some point in 05 and 06. The problem is we no longer count the long-term unemployed. We also have a long-term underemployed problem, and they never get counted either.
You know, this is a really important point. Dennis, do you want to jump on that? Underemployed and people who've just given up.
Well, right. And actually, that number does get calculated. It just doesn't get paid a lot of attention to. And that number of the so-called, what we're really talking about is people that are so-called discouraged workers. In other words, they may have dropped out of the labor force altogether. They're not counted in the unemployed. People that are working part-time and they want to be working full-time, they're counted as employed, but if you recalculate the unemployment rate number, that actually went up to around 14.5%, I believe, in the latest job report. So that's another way to look at the unemployment rate. Maybe it's closer to 14% when you take those other factors into effect rather than the 8.2, which is the headline number.
Gentlemen, there's another issue on the horizon that we haven't talked about, and that is, Matt Slaughter, the U.S. Supreme Court is set to release its ruling on the new health care law sometime this month, right? They break for the summer. They release all these rulings in June. If the Affordable Care Act is scrapped, Matt, or if it's retained, either way, how does this affect the business climate?
Boy, great question. Let's, independent of what you think about, I think a lot of the issues with the Affordable Health Care Act, I'll use it as a quick example of the uncertainty that's facing so many businesses in America today. So if you're in the healthcare industry, and we have a lot of great healthcare providers in the Concord area and elsewhere in New Hampshire, a lot of them, in different ways, their business right now hinges on what's going to be the Supreme Court decisions in terms of is the law upheld entirely, Is part of it, in particular the individual mandate, declared unconstitutional? Is the bigger parts of the law undone? So healthcare companies, which are a very large swatch of the U.S. economy, it accounts for about 17% of total GDP in America. This is a big issue for them. But whether your company is in retail trade or auto repair or high tech, you've got employees for whom you have to provide health care, and the costs and nature of the health care policies you may choose to provide for your employees, you don't quite know, given the uncertainty about the Supreme Court decision, what's going to be the nature of your obligations to your workers in the coming months and years.
So Supreme Court decision, Dennis, with major economic implications.
Oh, sure. And Matt's absolutely right. I mean, health care is a big part of the New Hampshire economy as well. Interestingly enough, healthcare is a bigger part of the New Hampshire, of the northern New Hampshire economy than it is the southern New Hampshire economy. If you look at the makeup of employment in the North Country, they've moved from a dependence on largely on the manufacturing sector to a dependence on the healthcare sector. Largely that has to do with the age of the population. The people are older. Poverty rates are higher in the North Country. So healthcare, in terms of an economic driver, is a big part of what goes on in northern New Hampshire. It's a big part of every part of New Hampshire. However, if you look at the major employers in most of the large cities in New Hampshire, those tend to be hospitals. And hospitals are increasingly becoming healthcare sort of
campuses in a way.
Campuses. I mean, they essentially have moved from solely the hospital model to running ambulatory care facilities to their own emergency, preparedness. They own gyms. They own
physicians'
practices. So healthcare is becoming more and more concentrated in a few facilities. That has implications, I think, too, going forward.
Well, you know, gentlemen, we've talked a lot about worrisome trends this hour. In fact, Matt, I'm having a hard time remembering if we've said anything positive this hour. And yet I've got a few friends and acquaintances who are small businessmen. I'm thinking of three of them, all employed in some aspect of the construction industry, although more specialized than, broadly putting up houses or apartment buildings. And all three of them are growing and hiring and feeling pretty good.
So that's great to hear.
Is that just a weird aberration? I mean,
it's not all bad,
is it?
No, it's not all bad in a couple of ways. And I'll stress, if you think of the Winnie the Pooh characters, we need some more Tiggers out there. And I tend to be a Tigger by disposition. So let me say two things on that. One is, even though we talk about these aggregate numbers and they're sobering, beneath that aggregate, there's still all sorts of dynamism in the U.S. economy. And one of those sources of dynamism that gives me hope is maybe not as much or as well as we did in the past, but we still remain one of the world leaders in innovating. And so hopefully, despite what's going on right now, that next Microsoft or that next IBM or some other industry in biotech that we don't even have yet is being created despite the trends that we're talking about. That's one thing. And the other reason I want us to stay at least somewhat optimistic is when you look historically at the level of countries, oftentimes the major policy reforms that countries put into place to really stimulate their economies over long periods of time, those policy changes actually come in the wake or in the middle of crises. So if you think of India and China, which we talked about a little bit earlier today, India's growth miracle that really started in 1991 started in the wake of a balance of payments crisis. The Indian government basically was running out of money, and they needed to go to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank for a lot of loans. And part of the conditions of those loans were to start to liberalize policies to allow business more freedom to operate in India. The same thing was true with China. China is an amazing growth experience. It started in 1978, and that truly was triggered by the death of Chairman Mao and the Cultural Revolution and all the chaos that came from that. So when I think about Europe right now, I think of Greece, and I'm hopeful that some business people in Greece and elsewhere are looking at that as an opportunity. And the people you cite in America or here in New Hampshire, Laura, boy, they're still out there, and hopefully more of them, despite the issues we're talking about, will continue to find new ways to innovate and grow new jobs in America.
So a crisis sharpens the mind, Matt.
It often does, actually, and at the policy level and for a lot of business leaders as well.
Dennis?
Yeah, I just wanted to add a couple of other optimistic things, kind of echo what Matt says. I mean, one of the things, and these are things that don't usually get a lot of press and maybe should, households are deleveraging. They're essentially paying down debt. They're, not only because of low interest rates, but also they're actually reducing the amount of debt that they're carrying. So if you look at debt service, if you look at financial obligations, households are getting in much better shape. It's improving credit quality. 30 to 90 day delinquency rates are down for first mortgages, for other types of liabilities. And the other thing I think that's happening, and we're going to start seeing more of this, is there's a lot of pent up demand out there. I mean, you can see it in automobiles. You know, the age of the fleet is pretty old right now, and a lot of those automobiles are going to have to get replaced. So as consumers, get into a better financial position, they'll be in a place where they can spend. We're seeing sort of the same thing in the housing industry. We should be, based on household formation, we should be, which is about 1 million a year, so we should be building houses at the rate of about 1.5 million a year, you know, housing starts. Right now, we're building houses at the rate of about 700,000 a year nationally.
Yeah, well below that.
And we're seeing similar, you know, on a scale, similar numbers in New Hampshire as well. So we're not even meeting replacement level for housing building. Those things are going to, I think, propel the economy going forward.
All right.
When we pent up demand becomes spent up demand.
Well, and Dennis, thank you for starting our weekend off, at least on a somewhat positive note. And thanks a lot for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dennis DeLay, economist at the New Hampshire Center for Public Policy Studies, New Hampshire forecast manager for the New England Economic Partnership. Matt Slaughter, forever I will remember your Tigger comment. Thank you very much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
As always, thanks very much, Laura.
Matt Slaughter, Associate Dean of the MBA program and a professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. He's also a member of the Congressional Budget Office's panel of economic advisors. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page where you can learn more about upcoming shows and get extra links and material. Our executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Canoy.